Price Talks. I'm Gord Price. I'm here with a guy whose name I really like. It's one of those names that has the right combination of syllables, two in the first, three in the last, and there's a combination of consonants and vowels that just trips off the tongue. Hi, Seti Pendekar.
Hi.
Seti Pendekar. It's a name I found easy to remember, I think, because it is so euphonic. Now, why would I remember that name? When they come to write your Wikipedia entry, they haven't done it yet, I checked. What's going to be the first line, do you think? What will people... Seti Pendekar, he was the guy who...
Well, probably the waterfront.
The waterfront.
Yeah.
I think you got to give us a little more detail there.
Well, when we got on council in 72...
Okay, let's stop right there. I'm going to fill in the first line in the Wikipedia entry, and it's going to be, Seti Pendekar was a member of the first majority team council in 1972.
Yeah.
The best council Vancouver ever had. Would you agree with that description?
I think so, in the sense that there were 10 extraordinarily competent people on council, with a mayor who was a very successful business person, and he knew how to manage extraordinarily competent people.
Who was that?
Art Phillips.
And who were some of these counselors who were so terrific?
Jeff Massey, Walter Hardwick, Bill Gibson, Fritz Bowers, Marianne Linnell, Harry Rankin.
Yeah, great counsel.
Yeah.
I've always felt to some, not to extend it too far, but we still kind of live in the team era. Much of what you achieved back then still works and lives with us today.
And it is the time in history also, in the sense that we were entering a period of strong citizen participation because of the anti-Free May movement of the 70s. And so it was a combination of circumstances. Citizen participation was one. New ideas won. People didn't want freeways in the middle of the city. It was a strong element of change compared to the previous city councils. And the whole idea of the citizens in different neighborhoods should be involved in the changes that take place in their neighborhood.
That's such an essential part of the Vancouver story now. Yeah. But let's go back to the Seti Pendekar story and figure out how you got to this team council.
I think it started when we were trying to, several of us independently, and Fritz Bowers, Bill Gibson, Walter Hardwick, and myself from UBC, and many others from the business community. It was Gowan Guest who had just come back from Ottawa after being executive assistant to Diefenbaker.
Diefenbaker?
Yeah. And established a law practice. And he was the one that brought together about 40, 50 people, and we met in his office every week for about a year and a quarter, maybe a year and a half.
So why did they ask you to be one of the 50?
Because of the basic fact I was agitating against the freeways, inner city freeways, and my participation in the fact that neighborhoods should decide their future, and we don't want freeways inside the city. We want them outside somewhere. And it was the right time and right combination of circumstances for those ideas.
Well, what were you doing then? Who were you?
I was teaching at UBC.
As?
Professor of Planning at the School of Community and Regional Planning.
Well, you would have been an early member of that faculty, too.
Yeah. Huh. I joined in 66 and then continued. But in 71, I took 2 years leave of absence, but it ended up to be about 20 months to work for the Minister of Transport in Ottawa.
Well, I'm guessing from your accent that you might have been originally from India.
Yeah.
Let me ask, when were you born?
long time ago.
1934. You're not even a baby boomer. You're a pre-baby boomer.
Yeah.
Greatest generation. What got you to Canada?
Well, you know, it's a short story I'll mention. I was admitted to the University of Florida in Jacksonville, Florida, and also University of British Columbia. University of Florida gave me a little bit bigger scholarship. But I arrived in the city and next morning got on the bus with my little handbag and was sitting on the bus, and I was sitting as I entered the door just very near the driver. The driver kept looking at me. And then some person from the back yelled, "You come back here." I didn't understand. And he came and touched my shoulders and said, "This is for white people only."
You literally had to go to the back of the bus.
Yeah. And, you know, I got agitated inside of me. That thought couldn't go away. I went to the admissions office and I got all the papers, didn't sign them. Then I met another person from Trinidad, from the same, he was coming out of the same office, and I said, "You know, this is the challenge I've got." He said, "I have the same challenge. I'm going to Montreal tonight. You want to come?" And I said, "You know, I have to go to Vancouver." And so he said, "Oh, let's go to the railway station and find a job and we'll get paid and also we'll go to Montreal." So I worked on the train to go to Montreal.
What were you doing?
Just making beds and cleaning bathrooms and just anything, you know, for a free ride and 65 cents per hour wages.
You had an engineering degree from India.
Yeah. But I wanted a free ride to Montreal.
But again, why leave India? You had professional status.
Yeah, I had professional status and a very good job. But I wanted to study some more. So the whole idea, UBC gave me a scholarship at that time. You know, $1,000 was a lot of money. The UBC tuition fee was $250 per year.
How old were you when you left India?
Oh, God, don't ask me.
Well, were you a young man?
Yeah. I had just worked 2 years after graduation, which means I was about 1955. I was just barely 23 years old, 22.
Truly, your roots
are
as an Indian.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you now at this point in life?
This point in life, it means, you know, no matter who it is, the early years shape your character, shape your relationships, shape your attitudes. And of course, over a period of time, these get amended, twisted, turned around and everything. But the basics are essentially formed when you're born until you're about 15 or 16 or whatever.
Can you say what it is that makes you Indian?
Makes me Indian?
Indian.
I think it's basic values about family, about, when I say family, I mean not only my wife and my two sons and their families, and close friends. It's mutual support when they need the support. During good times, it's easy to be friends. It's easy to be friends if all of your friends have money in their pocket. And the real character is when you want to be friends, even when other people don't have money in their pockets, and you want to respect them equally, and you want to enjoy the time together. So, I mean, I've been extraordinarily blessed to have good friends. You know, both from my high school and university days in India and university days here and my professional days.
Can you say then what it is that makes you Canadian?
I think my sense of being Canadian is caring for essentially this country to be one country instead of a group of provinces. And we're slowly getting there. You know, it's the, if you look at newspaper and TV coverage, radio and all that, over the last 20 years, it has changed. We talk a lot more about Canada as a whole than we did before.
Good to have that perspective.
Yeah.
Is it also what made you want to run for city council?
I think at that time, the primary inspiration for me to run for city council was to make sure that the freeways that were proposed did not happen for the inner city.
Now, what kind of engineer were you?
As in transport.
You were a transportation engineer.
Transportation engineering and planning.
In the 50s and 60s.
It's also, I studied at the University of Washington, my PhD. Therefore, I was totally aware of how the freeway system could divide your neighborhoods and make it extraordinarily difficult even to go to schools, hospitals, walking, crossing the freeway systems and all that. So I was, when I came back and started to work in Vancouver, I was more than determined that we did not have a freeway system in the city as a whole, even though we needed one when we left the city to go longer distances.
Were you a heretic?
Yeah.
Amongst the transportation engineers?
Yeah. I was, in fact, in the engineering community, I was a sort of a persona non grata, because they wanted the freeways and they wanted to build. You know, this is what engineers survive on. And it was more like, look at how much Seattle has achieved.
Huh. So, because you actually could see the results.
Yeah.
When you heard about the plans here, you were skeptical.
Well, not just skeptical. Wilbur Smith and associates had, Tom Campbell was the mayor, and they had produced a big study which would have harborfront freeways, South Fraser freeways.
Yeah.
The city would be consumed by the whole thing.
We've posted many pictures and renderings of that. What was, though, the general public sentiment, the opinion on that? What did the average person think about the ideas?
You know, when I came back to Vancouver, UBC didn't have an opening, so I started to work for a consulting engineering company. I had to actually mention to the vice president of the company, you know, you may have problems because engineers want the freeways and I don't want them.
And he said,
your personal views are not important. As long as you're doing good design job and relationship with the clients.
But the average person, were they even aware that these ideas were percolating?
It was not up so much for public discussion because the council had not considered the system yet. But this was when Tom Campbell was the mayor.
And Gerald Sutton Brown.
Yeah.
I guess we should mention him.
Yeah.
His name may be lost to history for most people, but who was Gerald Sutton Brown?
Gerald Sutton Brown was, in 66, he was, when I finished, he was, I think, director of planning, but in 72, he was already co-manager, the city manager.
Effectively the city manager, yeah. And he was driving, I believe, even a regional agenda for freeways. What did the council itself, did you get a sense of whether they really understood what was being proposed?
I didn't think so, because the election was a big surprise to everybody. Because
this was a 72 election?
Yeah. Because we elected 8 out of 10 people for team. And different qualifications and known people, you know, Jeff Massey.
Well, was the big issue freeways, or were you running on?
Yeah, I was running on the, we don't want the freeways inside the city. I was also running on a second important thing for me at that time, was to preserve and enhance the waterfront for people to walk and bike.
That was close to your heart?
Yeah.
Why?
Because basically I had seen what had happened to Seattle waterfront. Very difficult to walk on. You know, lots of private buildings occupying the waterfront and no access for continuous walkways. And remember, we didn't even have the Stanley Park, walkway around Stanley Park because we didn't have enough money. We had a little bit of a walk. We could walk continuously, yes. And Parks Board used to get, from the federal government, you know, the summer make work program and all that. But the city didn't have a policy on preserving our waterfront.
That seems today unimaginable.
Yeah.
Or was it just understood?
I think it fell in between stools, you know, Parks Board and city. There wasn't enough focus on longer term things at that time by the city. And when we got elected, this is the first thing we brought about, in the sense that Art Phillips was the manager. He was a good manager of the councillors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he assigned everybody a big chunk of policy spectrum. And he said, run with it, but keep me informed.
And you were minister without portfolio, in a way. They got the waterfront.
Yeah, I got the waterfront. And the vice chairperson was Mary Ann Linnell. And she was from the NPA, the loan counselor, along with Harry Rankin from COPE. The rest of us were team.
Now, the three of you were working on ideas for the waterfront?
No.
Oh, okay.
The Rankin...
This was your
task. Waterfront was...
So Art Phillips said, city?
Yeah.
Waterfront.
Yeah.
What did you do?
We didn't have enough money in the budget. Believe it or not. So Art Phillips said to me, go and talk to Ron Basford and see if you can squeeze some money out of the federal government.
Who's Ron Basford?
He was the Minister for Urban Affairs. He was the MP for Vancouver Centre. And Ron Basford, I went and saw him, and he said, yeah, we can support you for $5,000.
Whoa, $5,000.
Yeah.
And that's what you had to work with.
So we hired a consultant, and he produced a very good report for about $4,000.
What did it say?
Yeah.
What was the big thrusts? What did you want to get done?
We wanted a waterfront which would be not just the harbor waterfront and Stanley Park waterfront, but we wanted continuity. We wanted all the way from Wreck Beach at UBC that you could walk all around the waterfront and come back on the harbor and come back on, the Yaletown area, which did not exist at that time.
Well, they were all freight yards and heavy industry.
Yeah. And, you know, the Alderman Sweeney, he was a councillor, and his family had that barrel factory.
The Sweeney Cooperage.
Cooperage. And they used to dump all the, you know, we used to have sewer lines on the slopes on this, you know, south side from Broadway down the hill, all the way to Falls Creek. 6 feet in diameter pipes pumping raw sewage into Falls Creek.
Raw sewage.
Yeah.
No filtering.
No filters, no treatment, nothing.
It was a dead creek.
Yeah.
And no waterfront access for?
There was little bits and pieces of access, but no thought about continuity, long-term use, and cleanliness of the water, recreation in the water, you know. It was a different era, you know.
I can't imagine that anyone said these are bad ideas.
Yeah.
They probably just said, how much is it going to cost?
Yes, yes. That was the... And then until Ray Spaksman came from Toronto sometime in October of 72, I think, approximately, we didn't have the waterfront plan was controlled by the engineering department. We didn't have a planning perspective for the waterfront. So it was a completely different era of citizen participation and all that. And we brought these two things into the forefront.
So you bring back to council what exactly?
I brought in a comprehensive, our committee, Mary Ann Linnell, myself, or two others, three-person committee. And we brought together a comprehensive waterfront plan, which essentially, in broad brush statement, said, here we have, surrounded by water, English Bay, Falls Creek, Harbor, and Falls Creek, you know, the Yale Town area didn't exist at that time. It was one big provincial wasteland, land owned by the government until Expo 86. So the idea was to comprehensively think about 20, 30, 40 years from now, what do we want? So essentially, you know, I took a map with two or three other councillors, sat over a cup of coffee, and we said, the entire waterfront we want to protect. It has to be public access. People can build. Nobody is restricting anybody from building on their land. But if they own property on the waterfront now, and they want to build anything, then they have to dedicate the waterfront walkway. The only place where we could not do that was the Point Grey Road waterfront, because it would cost us an enormous amount of money and the city couldn't afford. So we started small. First thing we said was, the city owned, I think, 71 or 72 street end pieces of land. They were street ends on the water, street ends without the water. So we consolidated all of them and said, they're all going to be dedicated to be parks in the future. Right now, we may not have the money, but we're not going to sell them. We're not going to do something else with them. Even if it is a couple of benches and a lawn, just viewing spots, standing spots, relaxing spots, that's going to be our street end park.
And that, folks, is what you call planning.
Yeah.
So you got the vision.
Yeah.
You've got a way of getting there, and you can do it incrementally.
Yeah.
So Sonny Pendeker, in 2019, can literally walk out his door here in now Yale Town,
yeah,
and see the results.
Yeah. And it's,
I can see what you said. This, yeah, is what you...
Yeah.
Well, I hope you are remembered for this, Seti, because some of those policies absolutely did drive the agendas for,
yeah,
subsequent councils, particularly for the development of False,
yeah,
Creek.
Then remember, too, at a time when we got elected, Dave Barrett got elected as premier. 1972.
The NDP in Victoria.
Yeah. And we had people like Bob Williams, who were very supportive.
He was an NDP minister.
Yeah, lands and forests. I remember we had problems with some ownership of property and lands at the New Brighton Park. And went and saw Bob Williams in his office in Victoria. And the first thing he said is, I agree with you, we need the park. So he introduced me to somebody in the ministry to work with. And that's how we got the New Brighton Park done.
You could call up Peter Oberlander. You could call up Ron Basford, Bob Williams.
And then...
It seems like such a, well, we would say small town, but it sounds like people knew each other and could communicate regardless of their party. Yeah.
We also had a council where none of the councillors, including me, thought whoever we knew to get the job done was a personal secret. We essentially said, this job has to be done. And we talked to each other and said, who knows what and who knows who to get it done. And as councillors of team, belonging to team, we met once a week. Art Phillips coordinated all the agenda items. And that was, he was a good leader.
Where would you meet?
In his apartment. He had an apartment that he used just across from City Hall, and we met at his apartment.
You had a caucus meeting.
Yeah.
Hey, this is the back room everybody's talking. Yeah. So and what were those meetings like? What did you do?
It was extraordinarily useful, the idea, because we were so active. If we didn't coordinate, we'd create a lot of conflicts in priorities. What needs to be done is number one. And one thing we learned very quickly is that if whatever I was doing was number 8 out of 10 items, it was nothing personal. And that took a little bit of time and a lot of leadership by Art Phillips, because everybody has an ego. Everybody's project has to be number one.
Four professors from UBC, that alone could be a challenge.
Yeah.
Did you like each other?
Yes. We didn't. I knew Bill Gibson very well. I knew Jeff Massey very well because I'd worked on Simon Fraser University campus with him, with Arthur Erickson. Bill Gibson, Walter Hardwick, I knew very well. Fritz, I didn't know that well. He was from electrical engineering.
And did you know Harry Rankin well?
Harry, I knew from different community meetings.
What was his reputation?
Publicly, he was very left-wing. In in-camera meetings, he was very right-wing.
He was a founder of COPE.
Yeah. You know, and extraordinarily good speaker. He could stand up and entertain you immensely without much preparation. Yeah.
He was entertaining.
Yeah.
And very left.
Yeah.
And you got along?
You know, in public meetings of the city council, we always tried to point out at each other, pinpoint each other's shortcomings and in the statements. But in private, he was extraordinarily nice to me. I went to his office fairly often, closed the door and asked his opinion, advice on different issues. And he was very parental, very treated me like family.
Seti, you were the first, as we say, person of color on council, one of the first in Canada, I believe.
Yeah.
And you've been, as a South Asian, one of the only ones that have ever been elected. Is there something fundamentally wrong?
I don't think so. The at-large system makes it difficult for people to focus on your origins and heritage and all that. The advantage of the at-large system is that it leaves you above the fray. whether you're a short guy or a tall guy, or whether you're a brown guy or a blue guy, whether you're a man or a woman, it leaves you at the policy level. And I get quite concerned about the ward system or area representation, because it can entrench people. Oh, if you're not Chinese, you're not going to get elected. If you're not South Asian, you're not going to get elected. I don't think we need a system that encourages those attitudes.
The criticism is just the reverse of the at-large system. If you are Chinese or South, you're not going to get elected either.
Part of it is true. But part of it is, if you look at broadly, I think people who have been involved as either for a party, I mean, Vision elected Chinese people, and but he was not standing and speaking for that community per se. I like that. I think ghettoization based on your ethnic origins will be bad for the city.
Well, if not ghettoization, isn't it important, though, that a person of South Asian descent or any descent sees someone on council who reflects their world, who looks like them?
I think it'd be a good idea to have them. But more importantly, we need to find South Asians who are willing to represent the whole city rather than just their South Asian community.
Is the community large enough now? Has it not so
not
moved
not
off
in Vancouver.
To Surrey?
Yeah, there is a lot of movement to Surrey, both businesses and persons, families. And even in Surrey, the recent election show, just because you're South Asian, you're not going to win. Yeah.
Did you ever feel you were treated differently?
I don't think so. I think, you know, looking back after so many years, I'm quite open about it, because I was involved in so many controversial issues. I think a lot of people might have felt that I'm uncomfortable. You know, so many controversial issues, like the waterfront. Many people thought it would increase your taxes. So not increasing the tax is a very big issue, you know. It has been so many years. When I look back at history, I'm more sanguine about it. There was a certain amount of racism, but that was one of the reasons, not the only reason. I think combination of the fact that I had proposed a number of ideas that were fairly new, innovative, and somewhat radical ideas, many people felt uncomfortable. If you're going to do all this waterfront, what happens to my property?
Mm-hmm. When you look forward through the eyes of your children, do you feel that as Canadians of color, that their experience is the same or different?
In my case, it's a combination of both, because my heritage influences my values, family values, what happens to your neighborhood, what happens to your neighbor. And my education and training emphasizes the overall city. So I'm a product of both of those.
These were times also of great social and political change. You've already mentioned the NDP in Victoria, Trudeau in Ottawa, and of course, great social change.
Well,
how
we
exciting
also,
for you, really.
Yeah, we also created the social planning department. It didn't exist. Maurice Egan came from Toronto. Maurice Egan, Jonathan Baker, Ernie Fladell, these were very innovative guys to bring a focus on the social side of planning, the human side of planning, because the planning department historically had focused on the physical side of planning.
It was basically land use administration, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah. Bring in a permit, stamp.
Yeah. And land, but what social planning brought into focus was, it was land and people.
Yeah. Have you got a good example of what they did?
Waterfront plan was a good example. The other one was essentially the densities in different neighborhoods and not to spot zone. The idea of what is the neighborhood density rather than in the block.
And to ask people in the community what they thought too? That would have been a pretty radical idea.
Yeah. At that time, it was very controversial because people were used to the idea that they could go to the city and get rezoning done very, very easily as long as they had the money to build, you know, two stories, three stories or whatever.
Did it depend on who you knew?
I don't think it was anything personal like that. I think the policy was not written down, but more or less assumed that these things would be allowed.
Well, let's be blunt about this. Was there corruption?
I don't think so. I don't remember any instance or anybody coming to me with a complaint about corruption in the planning or engineering departments. But remember, a lot of planning was done by the engineering department.
Planning by engineers?
Yeah. Transportation was all done by engineering department. And we had a very good city engineer, Bill Curtis.
So we have at the same time the freeway fight. We have waterfront coming in as a vision. Local area planning. These must have been amazing times at City Hall.
Yeah, but then the good news part of it is we didn't step on each other's feet. For example, local area planning, the mayor made Darlene Mazzari and Mike Harcourt as the co-leaders of those two ideas. You know, I was leading the waterfront. Jeff Massey was leading the whole idea of design, urban design. And one of the things, you know, the first obvious thing without any scientific study was that we used to have these billboards. We still have them, you know, like 30 feet by 20 feet. So they were already there, many of them. So you couldn't remove them because it would cost a lot of money in compensation. So we said, from now on, you can have all your billboards any way you want, as long as it does not obstruct the view of the mountains or the water.
View corridors.
Yeah.
You guys did view corridors.
Yeah. And it was all done in, you know, two or three sentences. The policy was so simple that people were very sympathetic and understood that as you're driving up Burrard Bridge or Granville Bridge, you want to see the mountains. You don't want any building, you know, blocking your view, the beautiful North Shore or False Creek water when you're coming the opposite direction.
Or concrete high-rises.
Yeah.
What was your attitude then towards neighborhood development, density, high-rises, the West End?
We didn't have the pressure that the current councils have. You know, at that time, density actually meant two or three or four story. But we had been accustomed to the West End being dense. And anywhere else, it was not an issue. Spot zoning meant actually going from single family to duplex.
Oh my, it was a different era, wasn't
it?
So you didn't want to do spot rezoning.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
We initiated the idea of neighborhood planning and then the whole idea of what the neighborhood should be. And specifically asked the Neighborhood Planning Committees to come up with the advice as to where do you accommodate higher density and what amount of higher density. And it was not very scientific, really. So they came up with, you know, simple ideas like main traffic corridors. You can have a little bit higher density. As you go into the inner neighborhood, we should preserve single family. Simple things.
That echoes today.
Yeah.
Huh. You had Kitsilano, I believe, was the first local area plan, perhaps?
Yes. I can't remember at the moment whether it was West End or Kitsilano. One of the two were very active. Remember at that time, Sylvia Hotel and the next two buildings were the tall buildings. Sylvia Hotel used to advertise Dine in the Sky on the roof.
Yeah.
So now Sylvia Hotel is dwarfed by many, many, many buildings in the West End.
Well, in 1972, that was pretty much the end of the high-rise era.
Yeah.
I think throughout Vancouver, really.
Yeah.
There's this kind of missing gap, as it were, between the condo era that started in the late 80s and really your era.
Yeah.
So you guys had actually the luxury of not having to deal with these excruciating growth and affordability questions.
We didn't, to a large degree. At that time, to make planning for social housing integral part of the city planning was important. Maurice Egan brought that about. Jonathan Baker, Early Friedel. These guys were instrumental in making policy proposals which became an integral part of who we are now.
Sadie, this is why I love having these conversations, because we're dealing with exactly the same issues. It might help to go back and maybe read a few of those lines.
Then, you know, the innovative ideas, for example, we used the property endowment fund was started. So there was a lot of buildings that the city would get because of some people would leave the land, their homes to the city when they died, or some then estates when the properties were settled, some of them for taxes and all that. The city owned a large amount of individual pieces of land.
Particularly because of the Depression.
Yeah. And so the idea of the Property Endowment Fund and ownership of all the little buildings and property in one fund, used that fund more for public good than lying idle in different places.
My understanding is, though, that there are really two parts to it. One is many of these assets, and they have to be operated on a market basis. It's not used for, say, social housing, unless council explicitly says so. And so a good part of it is basically just backing the credit rating of the city. Do you think that maybe it should be used more aggressively for non-market housing?
It should be used, but I don't think we should write down any percentages for any use, because they get written in stone, and then we start to be inefficient.
To go back to spot rezoning, such a fascinating subject, did this work? You had local area planning, neighborhood plans. Did it basically do away with the need for spot rezonings?
It worked to a large degree, because if you look at, you know, the John Henry Park and the community centers in that area where Harry Rankin lived, and there was a lot done. And the idea of integrating community centers as, you know, the focal points of activity, not only for, you know, at that time the idea was that you go there for your physical exercise and stuff. So we brought in the idea of community centers being centers of activity for many other purposes. So Parks Board was strengthened.
What would be a good example?
Good example would be we had a park superintendent who just liked the idea of putting signs in all the neighborhood parks which said, don't walk on grass. How do you get into the park if you don't walk on grass? The focal point of history at that time for parks was really to keep them like a front lawn. You mow the lawn, you keep it clean, you water it once every 3 days or 4 days or whatever, and then it's just for looks.
You also wanted to make community centers more the focal point, just not recreation.
Yeah, beyond recreation. It should be community activity, and each community decides what are their priorities. They're different and they keep varying.
Is that how Britannia came about?
No, Britannia came over for two or three reasons. I think three people, Darlene Mazari, Mike Harcourt, and Harry Rankin, were the prime movers of bringing together the school, the library, and the community center into one complex.
Did the same in the West End?
Yeah.
When you look forward now, how would you like to see the city change?
I think the city, in my opinion, has to consolidate, doesn't have to change. And the biggest challenge is accommodating more people in the city in a peaceful but environmentally sound way. Even in the West End, if we allow willy-nilly all the tall buildings anywhere the developers want, then we're going to have problems with amenities and what the West End is and what the West End should be. And our overall density plan does not accommodate a lot of discussion. Because right now, if you're allowed, a 20-story building, you can, the only control is the design panel. And they don't do that kind of a good job.
Well, there is a development permit board, of which you guys were the originators.
Yeah, but the development permit board now has become strictly, legal or not legal. They don't interfere that much.
What was the original idea then?
Original idea was innovation. How do you produce better designs? CD1 was introduced at that point, remember?
CD1?
Yeah.
What is a CD1?
Comprehensive development. Zoning.
Isn't it, in its own way, a kind of spot rezoning?
Bigger than the spot. Sometimes an area, sometimes a mini neighborhood. But sometimes very macro, like the waterfront.
Your intent, as I understand it, though, was to deal, yes, creatively, but to streamline administration. We hear that in every election.
It worked to a smaller degree. And Spaksman did a very good job.
He was director of planning that you hired.
Yeah. But after Spaksman retired and Sam Sullivan and his director of planning, everything went far too much bureaucracy.
Ah, we're back where you started.
Yeah.
What would you do now?
I think to a large degree, they should detach parts of the development permit process from the planning department. Make it more efficient. Now it is not. I mean, we're building a senior center at the Sikh temple at 5th and Skeena. From the rezoning to getting a development permit, it took 5 years and 9 months. Rezoning people work like a clock. They do an extraordinarily good job of keeping relations with the community where the rezoning is done and, information to the people and all that. The rest of the planning department, works like a buffalo in the Indian agriculture. Goes forward most of the times, goes backward some of the times. And the only good news is it stops at lunchtime and breakfast time and dinner time.
A great study metaphor.
Yeah.
Well, have things changed so much, though, from your time that we really can't go back and think about the way that you were able to
I think write
a few lines, make a few phone calls, make things happen?
Yeah. It can be, because city is too big and too complex, and we're accommodating more people in the same piece of land. And the complexity now is the cost of housing. I'm not even talking about social housing. I'm talking about just a place to live. Even in neighborhoods where land is cheaper, West End has become totally out of range. Yaletown has become totally out of range. So either we want to be like what West Vancouver was when I was on city council.
West Vancouver.
Yeah, where only people with higher incomes lived. If we want to be that, we're slowly headed that way. And the new thing that the city cannot control and does not have any control is foreign ownership. We didn't have that problem then in the 70s.
You also didn't have a set of expectations and standards that we now have. A great example you gave me was how you leveled out the False Creek or the Stanley Park seawall.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
The expectations were different, and cantankerousness of the citizens was different. When people came to community meetings, literally a third or half of them spoke on the positive side of the proposal, whereas now 90% of the presenters are opposers, no matter what the proposal is.
Plus social media.
Yeah.
But tell me about the Stanley Park seawall and what happened.
Seawall, when we started to look at it, we didn't have much money. So Diefenbaker came up with the idea, and from that time, that project continued, where the summertime you could get money from the federal government for improvement of local amenities. So this was a period of a lot of growth in the city, so there was a lot of excavation. So we used to charge for people taking the excavated stones and soil and all that and dump along the Stanley Park seawall and on the embankment. And that way we got all the, stone and everything for the embankment for free, and then we charged them for dumping, and that money was used to build the seawall.
Let's just pause here to think about what you were saying. So if, say, there was a high-rise in the West End being constructed, you would take the fill from that site and truck it over to Stanley Park and dump it on the shoreline to build the seawall. Well,
yep. And then the money that came from charging the developers went to pay for building the seawall.
Do you think today, Seti Pendekar, we could say, hey, that fill you've got, take it over to a park and dump it on the shoreline?
Okay. Well, each period of history affords you some innovations, and we have to keep on thinking new ideas and new methods, because it's like a family growing up. It's when your children are very young, you think of different things. When they are grown up, you think of different things. This is a very mature city now. It's not a city where we can think of housing for everybody. In spite of our, concerns for all income groups to stay in the city, I think those days are gone. What West Vancouver used to be, we now have become. And there are still some areas where it's affordable, but we're not able to think in terms of little bit more consideration for densities in neighborhoods.
I think you said as well, just new ideas.
Yeah.
You're a mature man, like the city, said Pendeker.
Thank you.
Do you still come up with new ideas?
Well, some of those are new, some of them are old, but the ideas is essentially responding to crisis situations. Now it's housing for the younger people.
You had the opportunity to bring in new ideas at an amazing time of change. And I think in many ways, we are still in that era. Much of what Team did, those extraordinary counselors, strong leader.
Yeah. Well, it's for the younger generation to carry the torch.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Seti Pendeker, just a great name, great guy.
Thank you.
Thanks for the great hour we had together.
Thank you.